In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the economic policies of the Bush administration. And our guest for the show is Daniel Altman. He is a journalist and also economist. He has taught undergraduate economics at Harvard, where he got his PhD. He's also written for The Economist and The New York Times. Currently, he's an economic columnist for Business 2.0 and The New York Times, and is the author of a new book, which is titled Neoeconomy, George Bush's Revolutionary Gamble with America's Future. That's the subtitle. It's published by Public Affairs. Certainly, there has been quite a bit written about those advisors in the Bush administration that have been remaking American foreign policy, and they're often referred to as neoconservatives. However, there is another group that has been working to change American society, and our guest says that they have one goal, and that is to increase economic growth by changing the way the nation uses its resources. In his book, he says that might lead to greater prosperity, or it might not, but he also says even if it works, it might just lead to the collapse of the capitalist system. We will explore some of the ideas in the book this morning with Daniel Altman. And, of course, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief as they call in so that we can get in as many other folks as possible and keep the program moving. But anybody's welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. Mr. Altman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. I think that it's fair to say that if you look back to the time when George Bush, the current president, was running for president, and he talked about those things that he would do were he elected, the number one thing was the tax cut, and he got it. But in the book, you sort of make the argument that in the interest of the president and of Republicans in cutting taxes goes a little bit beyond there in this sense, that they had a purpose for cutting taxes, cutting specific sorts of taxes, that what they're trying to do, what they're hoping to do with the tax policies that they have adopted and others that they would adopt if they got the chance and the president was reelected, is what they're trying to do is to encourage savings. Right?
That's right. I think that there was some sincerity in what President Bush said about trying to give money back to people and get it out of Washington. I think that's been part of Republican dogma for a long time. But his advisors really had a focus, which they'd held for some years, though they weren't in government, on saving, because they thought that our taxes on capital income, meaning things like income from dividends and interest and capital gains, had been too taxed in the past, and that getting rid of some of those taxes would increase saving, increase capital accumulation, that is spending by companies, and lead to higher levels of economic growth.
Mm. So that's the concern here. That I suppose it's everyone's concern is economic growth, particularly over the last few years, as we have had a recession, relatively brief, but a very slow and sluggish recovery. So everyone is concerned with stimulating economic growth. And for the Bush administration and the Republicans in general, it seems that the one thing that they have always said is that if we cut taxes, that'll boost the economy. And apparently their argument is, just as you've laid it out, if we cut taxes on savings and also on wealth, that encourages people to save, then more money becomes available for businesses to put into their business. And then the business will go out and they'll buy machinery and do things. They'll do research and development. That means that then there are more jobs, presumably, more output of goods and services. And that eventually translates into higher living standards and everything's better for everybody. At least that's sort of the idea.
That's right. I mean, the first part of that, where you get more saving and more spending by companies, more capital accumulation, that leads to a one-time increase in the growth of the economy. And so we then resume our old growth trend, but from a higher level. So that means living standards should be permanently higher. But if they also use some of that extra money that's become available to them to spend on R&D and innovation, then we're going to see a permanent increase in the rate of economic growth. And that's really the utopian dream of these economic advisors.
This, as you point out, it's an idea that some economists have had for some time, that these ideas are not particularly new, and certainly they have been within conservative and Republican circles. These ideas have been around for some time. Where exactly do these ideas come from? Where's the academic foundation, the base out of which these ideas come?
Well, the models that give you the basic result that you would get a one-time increase in growth from this greater saving have been around for a long time, perhaps 30 years, depending on how you count and whose models you want to refer to. They were pretty well known to a lot of economists and fairly well accepted, though it wasn't the case that people were putting a priority on taxes on saving because they thought that the taxes that hit so many more people, the labor income tax rates, were too high, and that was a more pressing concern. And that's part of the reason why the Reagan administration put such an emphasis there. Now, the other idea that you could get this permanent increase in the rate of growth through investing in R&D, that came later. Those models developed, particularly with economists at Stanford University, in the mid-80s. By that time, the Reagan tax policy changes had mostly shot their bolt. And then when the first President Bush came into office, the deficit was so big that his hands were essentially tied and he couldn't do anything. He actually had to break his election year pledge of no new taxes by raising taxes. So this is really the first time in the second Bush administration that these economists have had a chance to put their ideas into action.
Mm. Well, as I said, and I think that it's fair, in all of the discussion now over the past couple of years about what government might do to stimulate the economy, that the Republican answer has always been one thing, that is cutting taxes. Now, other people have had maybe other kinds of ideas, and as you point out in the book, if government was interested at least in giving a jolt to the economy, at least over the short term, one thing government could do would be to go out and spend money, which would certainly not be the Republican philosophy. And then the other would be tax cuts, either something, again, that would be short term or something that would be permanent. And that's, of course, what it is that the president wants. The tax cuts, as the law are written, are not permanent. But he would like them to be permanent. He said that last week at the convention. He said that over and over and over again.
Yeah, there was a little bit of what I would lightly term deception in the way that the president and his administration sold the tax cuts. The economy was hurting, and they said that these tax cuts are going to stimulate it. These are going to give the economy the spark that it needs. But really, from the point of view of those academic economists who were advising him, the big priority was to make long-term changes in the tax code and long-term changes in the economy that would lead to higher growth in the long term. So actually, the real goal of these policies was not for short-term stimulus, not to help the economy in the first few years. Had that been the Bush administration's primary goal, I believe there were more sort of efficient ways to do that from the point of view of getting more bang for your buck in the short term. And targeted short-term tax cuts are one of the things that I would mention. They don't have the effect that the Bush administration has often slated temporary tax cuts as having, which is that they don't do very much because people just take them as a windfall. If you target the tax cuts to give particular incentives for individuals and companies to spend money, then I think that you can do quite well in the short term. But that wasn't the direction that they chose to go in.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Daniel Altman. He is an economic columnist for Business 2.0 and the New York Times, and is author of a new book titled Neoeconomy, George Bush's Revolutionary Gamble with America's Future. That's the subtitle, published by Public Affairs, and it is a look at some of the economic thinking behind the economic strategies of the Bush administration. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This may be kind of a simple-minded question, but I guess it grows out of the feeling that, at least compared with people of other countries, Americans historically have not been very good savers. Is there some evidence that, indeed, if you cut taxes on savings, the idea of savings will be more attractive, and in fact, people will save more?
Well, that's not a simple-minded question at all. Would that it were. We really don't quite understand the link between tax rates and saving as much as we should. This is actually a discussion I've been having a bit with Bruce Bartlett, who's another economic commentator on my blog at neoeconomy.net. One of the great questions in economic research is whether this actually happens when you cut the tax rates on saving, or that is the return to saving, all that dividends and interest and stuff like that, will you get more saving? And it is possible. When you look at it theoretically, there are two things going on. When you raise the return that people get to their saving, it means that they feel a little richer, and they feel like they can spend more money now and more money in the future. But if they spend more money now, that means they're not going to save as much. And that's the case, is that you could still get away with saving a bit less, but because the return is higher, you could still spend more money in the future. The other effect is that people say, well, gee, from an opportunity cost perspective, spending money in the future has gotten a bit cheaper, so I'm going to spend more money in the future and I'm going to save more. But those two effects are running counter to each other, and we don't really know which one dominates. So there's not clarity from a theoretical perspective, and so far there hasn't been clarity from a research perspective either. Bruce pointed out to me that the savings rate in Canada rose a lot after they cut the taxes on the return to saving, but there's some evidence to suggest that that was just part of the economic cycle, and now their savings rate in 2003 was down around 1%, which was lower than ours. So I would say it's really inconclusive right now.
Hmm. Well, just then, if you ask the question, as we outlined it, we did have a recession that was relatively brief, but then the economy continued to be in a slump and it's kind of sluggish. There's been some recovery, but the rate is not what I think anybody would like. If you and given the fact that the president said we think that cutting taxes will be good for the economy, and he got his tax cut, can you draw any sort of a line between the tax cut the president wanted and got and any kind of recovery, whatever recovery we've had since the recession ended?
Well, that's another tough call, and I think that there have been a lot of people supporting the president who've been eager to do that, and I'll tell you why I'm skeptical of it. The second wave of tax cuts, which is what they usually point to, came in at the end of May last year. Now, what else happened at the end of May last year? Well, it was just after we realized that the war in Iraq, even though we might be over there for a while and might be losing some soldiers there for quite a while, did not result in a lot of terrorist attacks in the U.S., did not result in an attack by Saddam Hussein on the Saudi oil fields. These were the big fears that people had about it, that would really result in a big decline in economic activity. And that was really the last of a series of huge shocks that hit our economy, that uncertainty leading up to the war. The first was the bursting of the stock market bubble in 2000. Then we had the 9/11 attacks and the tragedy there. Then we had all the corporate scandals that plagued the country through 2001 and 2002 with Enron and WorldCom, all the rest of those. And then we had all this uncertainty. And really, May 2003 to June 2003 was the first time we got out from under that. And a lot of companies may have been waiting to hire people or spend money. And this was the first time they probably felt they had some breathing room. So that could just as easily have been the cause of the recovery in the second half of last year.
Well, we have several callers here, people who are listening who want to join in the conversation. So we will do that. Go to the telephone. We'll just take them in the order that they came in. So we'll start with a caller in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. Do you think it's possible, even though it's simplistic to say, that the Bush administration's policies have basically devalued labor and work in favor of those that have accumulated large amounts of capital and investment income?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a devaluing. I think what they've done is decide to focus their tax-cutting priorities. What it does do is, in the long term, if you move in this direction and you cut all the taxes on the return to saving down to zero, then the people who are paying the taxes are the labor income people, the people who are wage earners, who don't get most of their income from their financial assets. And they're going to be a smaller and smaller group, because some of the wealthy people will try and move their income away from labor towards their capital assets, financial assets. And as that group gets smaller and as those other taxes go away, the tax rates that they face will have to go up in order to pay for all the things that the federal government does. So in that case, in that sense, they're moving the burden towards the wage earners.
Does that call, does it get at your question?
Well, I think it basically does. The big issue then becomes if the worker then has to pay a much higher percentage of their income needs for federal taxes, then in fact that makes the work they do less valuable because they get paid less net income for that work that they provide.
You could certainly draw the conclusion through that way. I just try to avoid words like devalue because it takes on a sort of moral or philosophical outlook. I'm trying to stick mostly to the economic arguments. One thing that could be pertinent here is the talk that's been mooted lately from Washington about a consumption tax. That would also get rid of the taxes on saving, but it would make it impossible for wealthy people to avoid it completely because presumably they'd still be spending some of their money even if all their income came from their financial assets.
Well, I think, you have one more question you want to?
One more question when it comes to revising the tax policy we have. If you took a Forbes program with a flat tax, but you graduated that flat tax instead of just making it one rate overall, so that the wealthy would have to pay a higher flat tax, would that help the economy or would that have a hindrance on the economy?
Well, it doesn't sound like a very flat tax anymore. Are we talking about a consumption tax here or an income tax?
An income tax that it would be flat in the sense that you would eliminate almost all the deductions across the board. But instead of taxing everybody at a flat rate of, let's say, 10%, you would raise that on a graduated scale so that people who had considerably a lot more money left over at the end of the year would have to pay a higher percentage than those that have a smaller amount of money at the end of the year. In other words, the problem I see in the economy right now is that there isn't enough disposable income for the average person in the true middle class. And that person in the true middle class does not have a lot of extra money in their pocket to go out and spend on the kind of products that stimulate the economy overall, like refrigerators, freezers, washers, dryers, that the kind of stuff that basically provides for good manufacturing jobs and that kind of stuff. The wealthy have no trouble with that. The wealthy can buy Lexuses or anything they want. But it's the guy in the middle who's getting squeezed really bad right now. And the Bush policy did really little to help that person in the middle. Now, I'm not seeing everybody in the middle squeezed. Obviously, if you own your house and your kids are out of the house and all, you're in pretty good shape. But if you've got to prepare for kids going to college and you haven't yet paid off your house, and property taxes, I don't know anybody in Champaign-Urbana, but everybody in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, looked at about a 50% increase in their property taxes in the last 10 years, and it's not going to go south. It's only going to get a lot higher. And that squeeze on your property taxes alone, most people are looking at probably, if they own a decent-sized property, and they're looking at about a $200, $300 raise every year in their property taxes. That eats up a lot of disposable income, too.
You touched on a lot of things there. I'll start by saying the following. If you got rid of a lot of the itemized deductions that you can make in your tax code, in your tax return, you would definitely see wealthier people paying more taxes. A lot of those deductions are primarily benefiting them. That's why you see wealthier people as being much more likely to itemize on their returns. Things like the mortgage interest on your house or things like deductions you may get from particular types of tax-free savings accounts, those are more likely to be used by wealthier folks. There's no doubt about it. The second thing that's worth mentioning is probably to do with the situation that you mentioned with people who've paid off their houses and everything, and are they getting squeezed in the middle? If we change the tax code significantly, then you could see rates go in whatever direction you want. But the point you made about property taxes responding when we have cuts in Washington is particularly interesting and something that's getting more attention now. The idea that when the federal government cuts its tax rates and perhaps helps states out less during a down part of the economic cycle with providing and paying for services, that those states and localities actually have to raise taxes to compensate. That sort of equilibrium is a very interesting thing that people are just starting to look at now.
Hmm. I mean, just if we have some other callers, I want to get to them, but just we passed just really briefly with what is, I think, a bottom line kind of conclusion that you have in the book that I just want to reinforce, and that's your argument that if we continue down this road and make further cuts and cut the taxes on things like interest that people get from savings and dividends they get on their investments and so forth, and move more and more to simply taxing wages, taxing labor, that is. So we'll have more and more, we'll have two distinct groups in this country, that is, people whose income comes from labor and people whose income comes from their investments. And that you seem to be arguing that not only would, if we did this and did as much of it as we could, not only would we further increase income inequality in this country, but more and more we'd have two groups of people, and one of the things that would distinguish them is that one group would be paying for all of what government does, because they were the ones who'd be paying taxes, and there would be another large group of people that weren't supporting the activities of government at all. And I suppose we can have arguments about what activities are good and what aren't, but probably everybody could find something that they think government does that's good. And here we would have a large group of people that would be essentially exempt from supporting any activities of government.
Yeah, well, you talk about simple questions. This is a simple process of events here, which is very easy to follow. You get rid of taxes on the return to saving, and people who can will shift as much of their income towards those returns as is possible, so that they will get all their income from things like stocks and bonds. You know, if they're the chief executive of a company, they'll say, don't pay me a salary. Pay me with a performance-rated bond, or pay me with stock options. Pay me with something where the return's not going to be taxed. However, you know, if you're a clerk at Walmart or Home Health Aid, it's a lot harder to say that to your employer, pay me with a bond. They're probably not going to issue one just for you. And so what you're going to see is there'll be people who are moving out of the tax base, and they're going to tend to be very wealthy people. And I believe that the American people is sufficiently intolerant of free riders that they're not going to like the situation. They're going to see a lot of wealthy people who are making a lot of money, but they're not contributing a dime to the federal government for cancer research or national defense or the war on terrorism, whatever you want to call it, all the things that the federal government does. And they're just not going to put up with that situation. And my worry is that the backlash against that situation could be worse than not having done anything at all.
Well, let's talk with some other folks. Another Champagne caller. This is someone on line number two. Hello.
Well, I think that situation is slowly but surely and surreptitiously happening in this country. And I'm not quite convinced that Americans, the average American, the middle-class American, the low-income American who are being squeezed out, are able to discern what's happening in light of Bush's tax policies that are tilted to the wealthy. And I'm going to say something. Republicans are poor, involved, and create class warfare, class polarization, where the rich get richer, the poor get poor, and we're going to have two Americas, to borrow the term of John Edwards, one rich, one poor, one bearing the burden of this country, and one getting off basically scot-free. And I think that's what's happening, but I think the Bush Republican administration can get us distracted with issues of war, terrorism, where we don't see what's happening in this country, where we have this chasm based on class.
Well, that's certainly one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is try and focus a little bit of this campaign debate on the economy, because I do think that what's going on there is really important. You know, it was interesting for me to hear a week or two ago the president saying, the Democrats want to tax the rich more. Why are you going to do that? They'll just find a way to dodge the taxes. I mean, he's basically proving my point there by saying that the rich are more skillful, they can hire financial planners, they're more literate, and they can find a way to avoid it. So in a situation where you have no taxes on the return from financial assets, it's not like they're going to sit on their hands and do nothing. They're going to take advantage of that situation, as an economist would argue they should.
The tax cut I've always been in favor of, to ease the burden on the middle class and maybe even the low class, even though they don't maybe pay as many taxes with the, low-income tax credit, would be a reduction in payroll taxes. And that was raised to the president. He says, well, we need to avoid that to make sure the Social Security system remains solvent, which I found a very evasive answer on his part in terms of how can you enhance savings among that group if you don't give them more disposable income. Is a stagnant. Health care is more expensive. Employer-assisted health care is fading away. One great way of eliminating a regressive tax and giving them more income would be to lower the payroll tax. And no one talks about that, including President Bush when he's touting his tax cuts.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that argument that you say he brought back is based on a fallacy that somehow Social Security's budget and the budget of the rest of the government are separate. They're
right.
Not. We only have one government, and it has a certain amount of money, and it raises a certain amount of tax revenue, and it has to do all the things it does using that revenue. Now, if you are cutting other taxes, income taxes, and leaving the payroll tax, you're having just as much as of an effect on the long-term solvency of Social Security. The government's going to have less money in the future. And to make the argument that keeping the payroll tax intact is the most important thing for saving Social Security, I think that's really fallacious. And the reason people brought up the payroll tax cut as a possibility during the downward part of the economic cycle recently was that it would give money back to people who were more likely to spend it, people in the lower and middle income ranges. They're more likely to spend a larger number of cents of every dollar than people in the higher income ranges, and that was why it was brought up.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. We have a couple of other callers. Let me just quickly reintroduce the guest for this hour of Focus, Daniel Altman. He's taught undergraduate economics at Harvard, where he received his doctorate. He's written for The Economist and The New York Times. He currently is economic columnist for Business 2.0 and The Times, and is the author of the book Neoeconomy, George Bush's Revolutionary Gamble with America's Future. That's the subtitle. It's published by Public Affairs. 333-9455, the number here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Real quickly, to make the point, I think in the book you talk about the fact, for example, that a fair amount of attention has been given to the Bush foreign policy, but not a lot of attention to what the thinking is in terms of economics. Now, you have written a book here that's intended for the general audience. It's not for economists. So, your hope is that you can get to people who maybe don't think about economic issues very much, but I guess the question is, how do we, assuming we think it's important, encourage a little bit more discussion about these issues and what it is we're doing, what the administration is proposing, and what might or might not happen if indeed those things are passed?
Well, I think the first step is to see the forest for the trees. I mean, we've had a lot of different changes in tax policy over the last few years, and we've had proposals for even more from the Bush administration, things that they would hope to do if they were reelected for another term. And they really all fall under this rubric. It's a very coherent policy, all driven by these long-term goals of greater economic growth driven through capital accumulation and perhaps more spending on research and development. And they really made a very significant choice here. There are other ways of pursuing economic growth, such as investing in education, investing in basic research through government, which are proven to help the economy grow in the long term. But rather than choosing those methods, which do take a long time to pay off, perhaps 10 or 20 years as kids get educated and new scientific innovations get taken up by companies, they've chosen this sort of big bang, which is a bit of a gamble because it's never been tried in an economy the size of ours before. So where they have chosen the hare, they've sort of ignored the tortoise, which is slow but reliable.
Well, let's go back to the phones here. The next caller is line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Great discussion so far. I was shocked to hear that Bush said that the rich will just find loopholes to avoid new taxes on the rich. That's just amazing. I guess the liberal media didn't bother to report that, so I'm just really shocked. Anyway, what I want to have is two quick questions. Bush has said consistently, and his administration has said consistently, that they wanted people to spend money, not to save money. I have never heard any linkage between all these tax cuts and people saving money. So that's kind of a new bit of information I'd like you to, kind of expand upon. I remember right after 9/11, Bush was specifically saying, go out and live your lives, do what you normally do, and then spend money. So the whole idea that linking tax cuts to savings, that's new.
Well, it's a hard point to push to the public because it's difficult to understand how you're going to get both of those things going on at the same time. In the short term, every government wants people to spend money because that's going to help the economy to grow in the short term. That's going to get more goods and services produced and bought up by people in the economy. But because you have to save to grow more tomorrow under their theories, they really had to sort of keep that under wraps, I think, at least in the beginning, that that's what they were doing. What the solution to this apparent paradox is that when you cut these taxes on the return to saving, you're hoping that both things are going to happen. You're hoping that you've cut the tax rates enough that people will feel richer and spend more today, but they'll also save more for tomorrow.
Well, I have just never heard the Bush administration say that. So maybe that's just my lack of attention. But that's just something that if that's their official policy, if that's their publicly stated policy, I've never heard of it.
Well,
I listen to NPR quite a bit. I'd be surprised if I missed it.
Well, you know, they did start referring to the importance of saving a bit late on when they talked about a big expansion of tax-free savings accounts like Roth IRAs, but it really didn't come at all in the beginning, the first couple of years of the administration. Now, one of the things that it's important to look at here, I think, is the idea that you're going to get this big increase in saving in the long term, and it's going to be driven by these tax cuts because, you know, what the economy needed in the past few years wasn't really the long-term growth. It needed to spur a spark, some sort of catalyst for the near term. And that's the way they sold these long-term tax cuts, as giving you that spark. But as I wrote in the book, it's sort of like going to the doctor for a headache and getting an appendectomy. I mean, at least you got some painkillers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was really only a side effect of what you were really looking for.
Interesting. So the other thought I had was, how does this relate to the old-school Reaganomics idea that that Reaganomics, people argue, did it work or did it not work? If you argue that it did work, what you do have to acknowledge is that it took 10 years or 8 years to really be able to kick in. Now, during that entire time that Reaganomics was in operation, and of course we have this from the historical record, this is not a theory, this is a factual set of events that we can look back at. During those 8 to 10 years that it took Reaganomics to work, the rich always were benefiting and the poor were suffering. The middle class were suffering. So we have the same kind of policies, the same kind of structure. Give the money to the rich. This is trickle-down economics. So how do we make the current argument today that this is going to help middle class and poor people? I mean, what's Bush's direct answer to that question? And then how does this relate to the conservative viewpoint of starving the beast? You know, libertarians, conservative Republicans, they have this phrase called starving the beast. We got to kill big government. And the only way to do that, the only way to get rid of all these quote-unquote social programs is by starving the beast so that there is no government. And we see Bush raising the national debt to unprecedented levels. He's cutting taxes at the same time. So how does all this jive together in your philosophy, in your thesis? And love to hear you answer that, and I'll take that offline. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you guys are bringing up a lot of great things that I'm having to write them all down to get back to all of them. The first thing that you mentioned was whether this was another case of trickle-down. First, I wanted to sort of correct you. It's not that poor and working-class people have been doing a lot worse over the last 25 years or so. You know, everybody's been doing slightly better. Incomes have been rising very slowly, but pretty much across the economy, the place where it looks like people are maybe getting screwed a little bit is that you just have a big gap between what's happening at the bottom and what's happening at the top. It's really a relative thing. But, you know, people are getting gradually better off as time goes on. There have been some authors recently who've been contesting this and looking back at living conditions in the 1910s or 20s and saying, "Oh, if you were poor, it was better then." I'm not sure I buy that. But if you ask yourself, how are these economic policies going to work? Well, if you do get this increase in capital accumulation and increase in research and development, and companies are able to make more high-quality products, it will mean eventually that wages will rise because every worker's labor will become more valuable because they're making higher-quality products. So that's one way this will work. Another way is, you know, the Republicans will tell you that in the long term, tax revenues will go up because the economy will be growing so fast, and that will allow the federal government to pay for more of the services that poor people use, which they fund through grants to the states. So So that's the argument. As far as the second point you brought up about starving the beast, well, that's definitely something that's going on right now. It happened during the Reagan administration as well, where you had a lot of military spending. At the same time, you had a lot of tax cuts. So there was a big budget deficit, and there was nothing that the next administration could do, really. The hands were tied in the first Bush administration, it's part of what led to him losing the next election, I believe. What you see happening here is a bit of the same thing. Spending hasn't been effectively restrained in Washington in this past administration. We also have this big increase in military spending again, and we've got tax cuts again. So the budget deficits are growing, and what it's going to mean is that people who come afterwards are going to have a much harder time putting in place the policies that they would like to put in place, or perhaps that they campaigned on.
Let's go to another caller, line one in Champaign. Hello.
Well, yes, I think that you hit upon something there that's very important. I imagine most people are not familiar with an individual by the name of Grover Norquist, but I would imagine that you are, and a lot of people point to him as the sort of the intellectual architect of the Bush economic policies. And I think that they very much are interested in running up the debt as high as they can possibly get away with, so that they can continue to weaken the power of the government to put any kind of controls on corporations or, those people of extreme wealth. And, it's all part of their plan. It's not something they're going to talk about because people would be incensed by it. But, everything they seem to be doing is pushing the gap between, almost everybody else and those people at the very top of the economic ladder, and doing things so that they'll have even more power. Maybe it seems a bit extreme of a statement, but I see us sort of moving back towards a day of, the lords who run the great, plantations or wealth or even maybe medieval times where you have everybody is a serf working under, some great baron or lord, and then just kind of moving in that direction.
Well, you're not the first person to draw that comparison. In my book, I quote a French economist who taught at MIT in Boston for quite a while. And he's now back in France, but he has been writing about these tax cuts and the way the U.S. economy is going, that it's going to take us back to some medieval time, or at least the sort of turn of the century back in the Gilded Age, where you had the sort of robber barons who were heads of these big corporations and masses of serf-like laborers. So you're not the first to make that comparison. Hopefully that will be a bit of an over-dramatization. But I think it's important to take the starving the beast argument seriously. I don't know if I would say that Grover Norquist is behind the whole Bush policy. He's certainly been influential in Republican circles for a long time. Glenn Hubbard, who's the dean of the business school at Columbia and who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for the first 2 years of the Bush administration, I'd say he's more of an architect of the tax policy. But one thing that it's important to note when you're talking about the government's budget deficit is that you will often hear from people like Josh Bolton, who's the head of the White House Budget Office, that when we cut tax rates, we're going to see more revenue because there'll be more economic activity. But a big part of this proposal is to get rid of the taxes entirely. The tax on dividends, for example, which they tried to erase last year but only succeeded in cutting, and all the other taxes on the returns to saving. If you get rid of the taxes entirely, you can't collect any revenue, and then you have to start relying on other sources like the labor income tax. The idea that you'll collect more revenue sort of becomes a bit flimsy when you get to what some people might recognize as the left-hand side of the Laffer curve, where you have no tax rate, so you don't collect any revenue at all, and the government's budget deficit just gets bigger.
Do you think there's any chance that there'll be, if things get worse, there'll be a reaction in the other direction, that there's any possibility of having, instituting some kind of wealth tax in this country?
Well, the estate tax is as close as what we have to a wealth tax. It doesn't apply to very many people in any given year, and it's scheduled for abolition at the end of this decade, though unless it's become permanent, that abolition will expire, along with the rest of the Bush tax cuts from 2001. I don't think that we're going to see a wealth tax yet. I don't see this political landscape changing very much anytime soon. I think it will take this situation where we get this big division in society in order to create the sort of backlash that would lead to a wealth tax. And I'm not sure a wealth tax is such a good thing. It could be quite a drag on the economy. And if that's the case, then we may end up in a worse situation than where we started.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know. I'm very pessimistic.
All right. Well, let's thank you for the call. Let's go to someone else. This is line two, which is also Champagne. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I saw someone, and I can't remember his name, talking about security issues. And even a few terrorist attacks against America, even as great and as horrifying as the 9/11, the real way to bring down this country is to ruin us economically. And, I see that happening with all of the things you've been saying today about, more and more people being squeezed with being given higher tax bills and therefore not being able to pay for the necessities to raise their families and whatever. And this whole notion of security for our country is really really an economic one.
Yes, well, I'll tell you what the thing that most people I know who are economists are the most worried about, and that is that somehow foreigners and domestic investors as well will lose confidence in the growth of the economy. You know, if this big experiment that we've had from the Bush administration doesn't work, or if we see ourselves getting involved in more conflict in the Middle East, more things that threaten our security and cause uncertainty for our corporations, will foreign investors start to say, hey, I can get a better, safer return on my money if I put it somewhere else? And will domestic investors in the U.S. start to say the same thing because they can put their money anywhere they want? If we get that sort of flight of financial capital away from the U.S., then we're in real trouble because we've been relying on that money, especially coming in from abroad, for a long time. And that's going to tie the hands of both the government and our corporations. And that's really the nightmare scenario. I think we're quite a ways off from that now. Some other commentators like Paul Krugman think we're a bit closer to that. But that's the thing that keeps people up at night more than anything else.
Well, aren't people threatening or are actually doing this, putting their money into euros rather than dollars?
Well, it's a very good question. Right at the sort of climax of uncertainty about the war in Iraq, I did write an article for the New York Times where I talked to some European venture capitalists, people like that, and some of them were getting a little jittery. There was no doubt about it, and said, if there's another war right after this one in Syria or Iran, then we may consider putting some of our money somewhere else. As far as the foreign central banks who hold a lot of currency reserves in dollars and euros, those are the ones we have to watch as well. We do know that since the advent of the euro, it's just been gaining as a source of those reserves, and it's something that it's worth watching very carefully.
Well, it almost seems as if they're gearing up with all the things that we've heard about Iran lately, that the scenario of this, well, we've already got our troops here and our airplanes and our big bombs and everything, let's just go take out Iran next, and even before Iraq is anywhere near settled. And I think that could ruin the whole economy.
I'm not a foreign policy analyst, so I'm not going to make a prediction there. But I will tell you that a lot of economic forecasters, especially on Wall Street, have become foreign policy analysts because those things can be just as important to our economy as the ups and downs and all the numbers.
I have to jump in here. I thank the caller. We have several other people. I'd like to try to get one or two in before we finish, and also just quickly reintroduce the guest, Daniel Altman. He's economic columnist for Business 2.0 and the New York Times. He's written a book that looks at Bush administration economic thinking, which is titled Neo-Economy, George Bush's Revolutionary Gamble with America's Future. Public Affairs Books is the publisher. We'll go next to someone who is listening this morning in Chicago. That's our line four. Hello.
Hi, I just have one quick point. You said that we were all doing a little better, but the Census Bureau just released figures that say more people dropped into poverty, and that seems to contradict what you said. And the main question I want to raise is that of foreign policy and economic policy. They seem to me to be really intertwined. Just the mere fact that we've got $5.5 billion bleeding out of us every month has got to affect our economics policy here. But also, your issue that you're raising about Europe being a better place for money, because there seems to be a question about whether or not we're going to be able to maintain a scientific and technological edge. There was some data about foreign applications, visas to immigrate to the United States in science and technology, and I think from 2001 to 2002, it dropped 55%. And then Jeremy Ripkin, who I guess you could call him a futurist, he's just written a book called The European Dream, where he says the American dream isn't good for the world, and it's the European dream is where we should be. And he's a person who's working in Europe, not in the United States. So I guess my question is that if we're banking on our development in science and technology, keeping our standard up and keeping us in the safe place for investments, that future looks like it's not going to happen or not going to happen very quickly.
Okay, I'm going to go through the two things really quickly. First of all, on the poverty rates, a lot of what happened in the past few years was as a result of the economic cycle, and I was just talking in sort of broad terms, trying to adjust for the cycle. Secondly, in terms of our technological edge, well, President Bush has frozen our basic research government in the government right now. That's for non-medical, non-military research, and that's really a great source of innovation in our technological edge. A lot of economists are worried about the fact that he froze it. Senator Kerry has said that he'd start bumping it up again. And in terms of migration, it's absolutely true that there has been a clampdown on migration here, and some of the people who might have been contributing their brain power to our country are pushing it somewhere else. I was working in the UK government as an advisor on the topic of immigration, and it's something that they were very sensitive to, you know, whether there was an opportunity there for them to get more people in. We can certainly continue this discussion on my website, on my blog at neoeconomy.net, so look forward to that.
Well, the point is that it's not just that we clamped down. It was the fact that people were not applying to come here. There's an article by Richard Florida, and he's saying that these free thinkers, these creative thinkers, do not like Americans' present foreign policy, and they don't want to come here. They're not choosing to come here. So even if we were more welcoming, this would not be their place of first choice. And that's the real issue, is what is our future? What's the economy's future if we're not the magnet, if we're not the place where creative thinkers want to work? That's why I mentioned Jeremy Ripkin's book, where he's saying Europe is the place. The European dream is the future.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Well, I want to try and get there. We at least one more caller here. We have a listener this morning in Terre Haute. Let's go there, line three. Hello.
Yes, good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
Mr. Altman, is that the gentleman's name?
Yes.
Glad to hear him making some of this wise wording put out here to the people. But, you know, I fear reality, and we all know what reality is. It's just sometimes we want to disguise it. And here's one simple thought I have. Instead of the government taking care of people, they should, and I believe it's mandated, that they take care of things to help people take care of themselves. And that is so simple, but nobody seems to grasp hold of that. And to get the taxes from things they do instead of doing things to get taxes, and I'd just like you to comment on that. Maybe that's just a bunch of words put together, but if we just all of us listen and live in reality, we'd know we got to do these things or else.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I would say that some of the things that government can do to make sure that those taxes and those tax revenues, I should say, just appear rather than having to go out and wrench them away from people is to set the foundation for long-term growth. And I think that the steady ways to do that are by investing in education and directly in innovation through research. You know, the Bush administration has another plan, and it could work. But it's unproven, and it's a big risk because there's a downside to it, too.
Well, I think at that, we're going to have to stop. My thanks to all of the callers. We've come here to the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading more, you can look for the book that we have talked about. It's titled Neoconomy by our guest Daniel Altman, published by Public Affairs. Dan Altman is economic columnist for Business 2.0 and The New York Times. And Mr. Altman, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
It's been a great pleasure. You've got very intelligent listeners.
Absolutely.